Today's Teisho will be on case one in the Heikigan Woku, the Blue Rock Collection. Emperor Wu asks Bodhidharma, Engo's introduction. Smoke over the hill indicates fire. Horns over the fence indicate an ox. Given one corner, you grasp the other three. One glance, and you discern the smallest difference. Such quickness, however, is only too common among robed monks. When you have stopped the deluded activity of consciousness, then whatever situation you may find yourself in, you enjoy perfect freedom in adversity and prosperity, and in taking and in giving. Now tell me, how in fact will this sort of person behave? See Secho's complications. Main subject, Emperor Wu of Liang asked Bodhidharma, what is the first principle of the holy teachings? Bodhidharma said, emptiness, no holiness. Who is this standing before me? Asked the emperor. Not knowing, said Bodhidharma. The emperor did not grasp his meaning. Thereupon, Bodhidharma crossed the river and went to the land of Wei. The emperor later spoke of this to Shiko, who said, do you in fact know who this person is? The emperor said, he said his name was Not Knowing. Shiko said, this is the Bodhisattva Guanyin, the Bodhisattva Kanon, the bearer of the Buddha's heart seal. The emperor was full of regret and wanted to send for Bodhidharma, but Shiko said, it's no use sending a messenger to fetch him back. Even if all the people went, he would not return. Secho's verse, holy teaching, emptiness. What is the secret here? Again, who stands before me? Not knowing. I want to thank you all for coming here today to practice Zazen. meditation is becoming quite popular in the United States. I was reading an article just the other day, and they said that something like 25 million people have been exposed to and maybe practicing to some degree yoga. And they said, along with yoga, there has been a great interest in meditation. And they estimate that 10 to 15 million people have tried some form of meditation. So this is pretty remarkable change, pretty amazing change. If 10 to 15% of Americans have practiced meditation or at least tried to practice meditation, that's quite a, you know, when I was growing up, nobody had ever even heard of meditation. You know, if somebody said, "What are you going to do today?" and I said, "I'm going to go meditate," they might call the police. You know, they would have no idea what I was talking about. When I was growing up, you know, basically, if you were a vegetarian, that was considered absolute lunacy, right? That was like, that was as far out as you could go, a vegetarian, you know. They used to call people like that health food nuts. So he's a health nut, you know. So something like meditation, and yoga too, you know, yoga was most people couldn't tell yoga from yogurt, actually. And, you know, basically, this was just not part of 1960s and 1970s America. I was reading something else where Jack Kornfield, I don't know if you've heard of him, but he's a meditation teacher, and he said one day some guy was filling up his, this is quite recently, was filling up his car at the gas station. And the guy said, well, so what do you do? And Jack Kornfield says, oh, I teach meditation. And the guy paused and he said, oh, I could use some meditation. And Kornfield said, you know, that's really a change. You know, not only does the guy know what it is, but he's thinking, you know, I could probably benefit from meditation. So I think that's really quite wonderful. You know, I also think the growth of yoga is just quite wonderful. You know, people, yoga is a kind of moving meditation. It's very good for you, and it has many health benefits. And of course, meditation is, you know, also really wonderful for you and has many amazing health benefits. So just the fact that people are practicing these paths is really exciting to me. And this is in a relatively short period of time. I think part of it is that these paths really help you. You know, if you try yoga, it's actually quite challenging, you know. If you do yoga once a month, you're wasting your time, you know. You will never get anywhere. You have to do yoga regularly, and that takes discipline. You know, just developing discipline is wonderful in itself, you know? So if you go to the yoga studio every week, you know, you have to get up, you have to go to the yoga studio. You know, you can't eat too much before you do yoga, or you can't really do it well. So you have to, you know, basically practice mindfulness throughout the whole period. You know, you have to practice mindfulness before you get to yoga. You have to practice mindfulness when you do your yoga, and you have to practice mindfulness when you finish your yoga. You know, so just that in itself is really wonderful. And then, you know, there's the physical aspect, and yoga is difficult, right? It's hard. You really have to stretch. You know, it's not easy. You sweat. You know, sometimes you're covered. You don't need Bikram yoga. You don't have to have the temperature turned up to 100 degrees or 120 degrees. Just regular yoga. You'll be covered with sweat sometime, right? And it hurts, you know? When you get into some of these postures, the whole point is you're supposed to go a little bit farther than your comfort zone. So you stretch to your limit, and then you're supposed to stretch just a little more, right? Just a little more. If you do it too much, you can injure yourself. But if you always just go to your comfort zone, you can't grow. See? So you know, when you're doing a posture, you know, there's limits to your flexibility. When you're performing an asana, in other words, when you're performing an asana, you know, there's a moment where you're reaching the limits. I can't compress this leg, or I can't stretch this leg anymore. And so a good yoga teacher will say, now come on, let's take that knee back just a little bit more. And right? But, you know, when you're done, you feel so good. Feel so wonderful, right? And people usually who get into yoga, you know, also develop other positive habits. You think, well, you know, if this is good for me, what else might be good for me? You know, if yoga is good for me, maybe I'll try some yogurt. You know, maybe I'll try rice instead of bread. You know, so people begin to change their lives. You know, this is really positive, I think. You know, and meditation is a lot like this too. You know, meditation is a lot like this too. You know, meditation is actually harder than yoga. There's no question about this. You know, there's lots of reasons for this. You know, when we have meditation on Sunday morning in a little town called Stanhope, which is near Lake Hopatcong in northern New Jersey. And I get up there, and sometimes every other Saturday, Sunday, Sandy gets up. And we both go up there, and there's meditation every Sunday at this location, this yoga studio. And, We have a history of using yoga studios earlier than people arrived for yoga. So, you know, we had another yoga studio for a while in Blairstown, and there was another one in, well, we've used a couple of venues, you know. And, you know, we usually start at 7 o'clock, and, you know, there might be 5, maybe 10 people there. And then we wrap up, and then the yoga crew comes in, and that's always more. It's always like, you know, 15 people. And you know, so I think part of it is maybe just getting up a little earlier. But I also think part of it is actually meditation is harder than yoga. It's definitely so. You know, in America, yoga has become just like an exercise routine, you know. But in India, you know, yoga was understood to be a form of meditation, you know. So, you know, if you go to some yoga studios now, it's almost like being at a gym, right? There's mirrors around the room. Everybody wears beautiful yoga clothes. You know, we've done meditation in yoga studios, and we're all leaving, and you know, we're all wearing our sweatpants and T-shirts, and you know, we're very casually dressed, and then all the yoga people come in, and they're beautiful, right? And they have these beautiful clothes. And, you know, flowing hair and, you know, these mats, these, you know, like a lavender mat and yellow pants or, you know, very beautiful. It's like a circus is coming to town. You know, and we have our dark mats who are coming out in our dark clothes. You know. So you know, yoga, you know, more people go to that. And it's, you know, people in America have turned yoga into something very American. And it's good and bad, right? There's good and bad aspects to this, right? You know, so it's become physical fitness. It's become like a bit of a beauty contest, right? There's an element of that, right? And everybody's into, like, the body beautiful and so on. And they forget, you know, really that's not what yoga was all about. Yoga is really meditation practice. But it's a sort of like introduction to meditation. So if you know, many people would have a very hard time sitting down on a cushion and watching the breath. If you did that easily when you started meditation, that's very unusual. You know, most people, that is very, very difficult. So something like yoga is much more accessible to a lot of people. You know, so they learn to do some elementary asanas. They learn how to breathe through the dantian, through the hara. They stretch. You know, most people don't have the flexibility to sit on a mat. So they're stretching all the time, developing flexibility, developing concentration, you know, learning to move, to synchronize your movements with your prana, with your chi. You know, this is all excellent, you know. All the asanas were originally part of a system of asanas. All the postures in yoga were part of a system that's supposed to culminate in what's the perfect asana. And the perfect asana is the lotus position, is the lotus posture. So all the asanas are supposed to be leading you to the cushion and leading you to do what we do, you know, meditation, seated meditation, zazen. That means seated meditation, you know. So that's the secret of yoga that's sort of forgotten. And yoga is a wonderful preparatory practice, really wonderful preparatory practice for meditation. Because people who can't sit still can learn to move and watch the breath and synchronize those. And eventually they get to a place that's still, where their minds are more still. You know, it may take an hour or an hour and a half of yoga for them to enter kind of samadhi state, where in the mind becomes still and motionless after the body has been involved in all these different motions, you know. So it takes some people some work with the body to get to the stillness that we require to sit on the cushion. This is definitely so, you know. And some people take them a long time to get to that stillness through yoga. But I'm thrilled that yoga is becoming so popular. It worries me a little bit that it's become so commercialized, and that it has become Americanized, very much like a money-making scheme. You know, there's definitely an element of this in yoga. It's a kind of a business. And I'm sure you've heard that this guy, there's a number of people who have tried to patent yoga asanas, which are thousands of years old, right? But you know, so it's this is going on, right? It's unpleasant, right? But predictable in some ways, right? So there's a danger that this wonderful practice of yoga will lose its bearings, and it will be the inner quality, the inner properties of yoga, the liberating inner dimension, will get like stripped out, and it will just turn into this kind of mechanical exercise routine without this inner dimension. This is a real danger, right? So I'm happy yoga is growing, and I just hope it can maintain its focus, right? Maintain its focus. And there's some danger it might not, you know. But this is actually true with meditation also. There's actually a danger, I think, with meditation also, that it's going to lose its focus or lose its bearings. You know, earlier I said something like 20 to 25 million people have tried yoga in the United States. And it might be 10 to 15 million people have tried meditation. And I'm very, very happy that people are interested in meditation. But the same kind of problem that has happened in yoga could happen with meditation too. So the kind of meditation that has become very popular in the United States is called mindfulness meditation. And there are lots of people who have written books on mindfulness meditation. You know, mindfulness this, mindfulness that. When we have our beginner's nights, Monday and Friday, whenever I ask people, have you meditated before? They often say yes, and I'll say, what kind? And they'll say, mindfulness, right? So this is wonderful in a certain way, like the fact that everybody does yoga. The fact that people are doing mindfulness meditation is really wonderful. I'm so happy. It's worlds away from the universe I grew up in when I was a kid, you know? When I was growing up, when people are stressed and unhappy, they have very few outlets. You know, people didn't know what to do about that. Even like jogging was not part of the scene culturally. So, you know, exercise was something muscle men did at the gym, you know, but it wasn't something ordinary people did on a regular basis. So you didn't see people jogging in the afternoon and things like that. That was all to come later, you know. When you had stress or you were unhappy, most people drank. You know, that was how they coped with their stress and their unhappiness, was through alcohol. It was just like the cultural ritual. At the end of the day, everybody would have a drink, you know. So we didn't have anything like yoga. We didn't have like exercise, like jogging. And there was nothing like meditation. So I'm so happy now that we have meditation. And mindfulness is a wonderful practice. You know, wonderful. I'm not in any way criticizing it. But I think there's a danger that the essence of mindfulness could get lost too. Just as the essence of yoga is getting lost a little bit, maybe. Mindfulness is a very accessible practice, right? It's simple. It's very direct. You learn to pay attention to your sensation. You start with the breath, and then you learn to observe the moment, observe sensations in the moment. And in some traditions, you just observe the sensation. You note the sensation from moment to moment, in sort of indiscriminately. What are you aware of from moment to moment? And in some traditions, you actually name it. You know, so. If you're sitting on the cushion, you might notice breathing. You might notice something else, that you have pain in your leg, you know, feeling pain or something like that. And so some traditions it's just a bare awareness moment by moment, and in some traditions there's you put a label on your experience, you know. And you know, I see lots of people who benefit from mindfulness, sitting down on a cushion, watching the breath. That's all to the good, you know. So this is very, very big improvement over, say, 40 or 45 years ago. And the fact that people know what meditation is and that they even do a little bit of it is really good. But it does worry me just a little bit that the essence of meditation might get lost, you know. Because, if you use meditation just as a stress relief, just as like a coping mechanism, this is good and this is bad, in my opinion, you know. Good and bad, maybe not the right terms, but there's a there's an upside and a downside to doing that. You know, so the upside is that you don't turn to more destructive kinds of behaviors in responding to your circumstances. So if you're unhappy at work, you don't come home and have three martinis. You know, maybe you do some meditation, and when you get off the cushion, you feel a little better, and that's great. It's helped you in your life. So important, right? You know, that's wonderful. And, you know, just sitting down on a cushion and watching the breath is hugely beneficial. After about 15 or 20 minutes, most people who practice regularly have a deep relaxation response. It's just wonderful. So you can be really tense, and after about 20 minutes, you'll have this deep relaxation response, and it's just like, release. So beautiful. So that's really excellent for people, you know, and it helps your pulmonary system, endocrine system, all these things benefit from just like relaxation on the cushion. So the fact that people come home and instead of having a drink or, some other kind of very destructive behavior, they do meditation, this is hugely good, you know. So they don't, fathers don't come home and scream at their kids, you know, maybe they actually go in and meditate and they come out and they're actually sweet and nice, that would be good. But, there is a danger all the same because, it doesn't necessarily change your way of life. It doesn't necessarily change your basic mental habits. So, you know, if you have a lot of stress, doing meditation could release your stress, but why are you so stressed? See? And you could say, well, I'm stressed because my boss is an SOB, right? But actually, the boss is really not the reason you're stressed, honestly. You know, the reason you're stressed has a deeper source. And if you're just using meditation as a coping mechanism, you're not getting at that deeper source. I hope I'm being clear. I'm not criticizing using meditation to cope. But, you know, a lot of our problems have deeper roots that we may not be getting at just by using meditation as a coping mechanism, right? And there's a larger issue of our values, you know, our values, how we live our life. So, I feel that the core of meditation, the core of meditation, at least in Buddhism, is this experience of emptiness. Emptiness. Very important. You know, the other day, I got a call from the editor of the Courier News. I don't know if you ever read the Courier News. I myself never do, and if you ever meet the editor, don't tell him that. Because he called me up and he said, listen, we would like you to write a column 5 times a year on Buddhism. You can write on anything you want. It has to be 500 words. So I said, sure, I'd be happy to do this. So I wrote one and sent it to him, and it seems to be okay. And I thought, what could I talk about? You know, if I were going to talk about Buddhism, what could I talk about that would be the best thing to acquaint people with Buddhism? You know, and I could have talked about meditation, I could talk about compassion, but instead I decided to talk about emptiness, you know. And You know, emptiness is actually a difficult concept for people, right? You know, most people, especially in the United States, you know, we think of a good life as a full life, full. So when we think of how can we be happy, we think, how can I fill my life? You know, so full of friends, full of purpose, full of, you know, challenges, full of joy, full, 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 full. So this is very much in our culture. This is very much part of American culture. This idea of fullness is good, emptiness is bad. You know, and this article is really sort of like I talk about this. You know, I don't get into 500 words isn't much, right? You know, that's not a lot of space. So I had to be very economical. And you know, the truth is that the average newspaper reader reads at about a ninth grade level. That's a fact. So I try to make it very, very simple and clear. That was a challenge, you know. But I did want to talk about the fact that, you know, we're into fullness, but, you know, often trying to have a full life can make us feel very unhappy, actually, you know. So you know, basically we pack so much into our lives that we don't have a moment to breathe or to look around or to learn and grow. This is a classic American issue, right? You know, we're supposed to be busy all the time. We're filling up all the time we can with something. And then every once in a while we have this sense of claustrophobia or like we don't control our lives, we're just being swept along, right? So there's a real value in this article. I try to make the case. There's a real value to nothingness, to emptiness. Because, you know, instead of trying to fill everything, you give yourself room, some space to do something new or try something new or be somebody new, right? And meditation practice is very much about this issue, at least in Buddhism, in Zen, right? You know, it's okay if we use meditation to cope with our lives, but it would be even better if we could change ourselves and change our lives, right? You know, so the goal of meditation is to produce a bodhisattva. The goal of meditation is actually to produce a Buddha, you know, which is a very lofty goal. But the reason we Zen people practice meditation is to become enlightened people. And enlightened means we have freed ourselves from our illusions. And one characteristic of an enlightened person is that he or she is sort of like boundlessly compassionate. Right? So this is like the hidden goal of meditation practice. It's not just... people can use it to cope, but it's not just about coping. It's about changing yourself to become a bodhisattva or a Buddha, an enlightened being. Right? Now that's a lofty goal. That can take a long time. To be a truly enlightened Buddha is actually the work of, in Buddhism, the work of many lifetimes. So in the Diamond Sutra, the Buddha says, you know, I've been a very compassionate being for many lifetimes, many lifetimes. And my last lifetime, I was ethically, morally impeccable person. And I was ruthlessly murdered by the Raja of Kalinga. And if I had given way to hate, even for a split second, I would not have been reborn as the Buddha. So that's a very lofty goal, right? Imagine if somebody did some harm to you and instead of feeling anger, even as they were harming you, you felt compassion. That would be close to the way a Buddha responds to events. So none of us are Buddhas, but we're all working on being Buddhas, right? So it takes work. And the way to become a Buddha is basically Zazen. And the door, the core of Zazen, is this practice of emptiness. So this is a koan about this great emperor of China, one kingdom in China called Liang. And Emperor Wu was very interested in Buddhism, very interested, and he had many different monks and nuns from India were coming to China and bringing the Dharma. And he was financing temples and think tanks and libraries and, you know, these sorts of things. Building, and he was totally enthusiastic. And then he had the chance to meet this monk from India named Bodhidharma. And Bodhidharma was a great Zen teacher. He was a teacher in the Zen sect, which didn't exist in China at that time. And so somebody arranged an interview between Bodhidharma and the Emperor of China, Emperor Wu. And, you know, the meeting was not a success, we learned, right? It wasn't a success. Basically, there's a conversation, and the emperor says to Bodhidharma, "What is the first principle of the holy teachings?" And Bodhidharma says, "Not holiness, emptiness." See? And the emperor's, "What? What?" He doesn't get it at all. He thinks this is about holiness, whatever holiness is. And Bodhidharma says, No. Holiness is just an idea. If you cling to an idea, you cannot wake up. You cannot change. So he said, not holiness. He says, emptiness. Okay. And the emperor is thunderstruck. He doesn't know what to make of this. And he says, who are you? You know, I thought you were a great Buddhist monk. Who are you? Who is this standing before me? And Bodhidharma says, not knowing. He says, I practice not knowing. I practice not knowing. But the emperor doesn't get it. He says, not knowing? Don't you have a name? Right? You know that. And the emperor did not grasp his meaning. Thereupon, Bodhidharma left. It's like, okay, you know. And he goes into the land of Wei, and he goes to what later became Shaolin Monastery, and he sat in a cave for 9 years until appropriate students showed up. And Bodhidharma leaves the royal compound, and the emperor is left with his advisor, Shiko. And the emperor says, who was that guy anyway? Shiko says, who was that guy anyway? And the emperor says, he said he didn't have a name or something. So Shiko said, wait a minute, do you know who he was? That was the embodiment of compassion. He was the embodiment of compassion. Now the emperor is thinking, oh my God, what have I done? Let's get him back. And Shiko says, oh, too late. You know, he's gone. So this story is about a person who is practicing the way, but, you know, in a way that's mistaken or confused. A little bit like all these people who do yoga for physical beauty. Not that there's anything wrong with physical beauty. And you know, having a nice body is nice, right? That's good. But it's not the heart of yoga. And if you're just practicing meditation to cope, well, I'm happy for you. And there's nothing wrong with that. But if everybody practices meditation just to cope, you know, we're not really getting to the heart of the matter, right? And we're not changing anything, right? We're just continuing in the same way. You know, it's just a stress relief, right? And that's great. But it's not changing us, and it's not changing the world, right? So, you know, the goal of enlightenment, the goal of Zen is enlightenment, and the door to enlightenment is emptiness. You know, emptiness is really wonderful. You know, it's very difficult for people to change. Very hard. It's very, very difficult for human beings to change. And yet humans, you know, in Buddhist thinking, humans are the only being who can change. Isn't that interesting? You know, the Buddha said it's wonderful to be born a human being. He said, it's very rare for people to be born a human being. He said, if you imagine a turtle swimming in the ocean, and you know, the ocean is a big place. Somewhere in the Pacific Ocean, there's a turtle, and he's swimming. And he's swimming through the ocean, and somewhere in India, somebody threw, like a harness for a plow. So a horse can pull a plow. Maybe you've seen these harnesses. They're made of leather. And they go over the horse's neck, and the reins hang off of them, and basically you attach the reins to this collar on the horse, and the horse pulls the plow. Well, collar was thrown into the Ganges River, and it flowed down the Ganges River, and it flowed out eventually and made its way to the Pacific Ocean. And now a turtle is swimming in the Pacific Ocean, and he just happens to come up in the water, and his head goes through the yoke, through the hole of the collar. The Buddha says that's a chance, those are the chances of being born a human being. It's a very lucky break. Right? And humans are so special in the Buddha's view because we can change. You know, animals can't really change very much, right? I mean, animals have their instincts. And animals are wonderful creatures and should always be treated with compassion. But, you know, they can't really change very much. And actually, in Buddhist thinking, in Buddhist mythology, the gods can't change either very much, right? The gods are just, they stay the same way for like thousands of years, right? You know, they're just gods. You know, they don't change. But humans have this capacity to change. But it's very hard even for humans to change when we get locked into our habits, when we get locked into our culture, which seems so real. You know, right now, the thing that is so important to humans is money, right? Everything about our culture is money. It's everything, you know. I know many people, the first thing they do is to check the stock market when they wake up in the morning, you know. Money is everything. You know, people go to school and they think, what'll I earn? You know, this is an intelligent response to our culture, you know. Money is very important in our culture. A friend of mine is living a very, very restricted income, and he said, do you know it takes $20 to get into New York? And he's right. Just getting on a train into New York costs $20. That's a lot of money, right?
26.
26. All right. That's even more money. So money is important, I admit, you know. But you know, it might be someday people won't be able to believe this is how we lived. They'll say, didn't they know about clean water? Why did they cut down all the trees? You know, why did they do this? You know, why did they, you know, superheat the planet? You know, where was their head? You know, why didn't they change? But it's so hard to change. You know, so when you sit down on the cushion and you enter Wuxin, it becomes possible to change. And it's, you know, the first time you watch the breath and you get to this blank place, it might seem trivial. You know, it's a so what, just a little blankness, you know. The other day, somebody came up to me and said, you know, I'm working on the Mu Koan, and I've been very diligent in my practice. And he said, I got off the cushion the other day, and I was walking around, and I realized my mind was thoughtless. I was in this thoughtless state walking around, you know. And he said it lasted for hours. And he said I finally started playing like a pinball machine or something, and it went away, you know. Well, you know, that is really wonderful, you know. That's a deep experience of Mu. You're really changing yourself when you do emptiness meditation. You're changing the way you process information, right down You could say the granular level, how you process from moment to moment is really changing. So this experience of emptiness is so important, right? It gives us the ability to live a different life and also to see our unwholesome practices, our unwholesome habits. Normally we can't see them. You know, we can't see our fear. We can't see our anger. We can't see our, you know, passion, out of control passions, right? You know, these are all things that just sweep us along. And you know, sometimes when you are able to enter a mushin and stay there for long periods of time, you know, you can see your life in a different way. You know, long ago in a sesshin, you know, somebody came into Dokusan, and he was crying. You know, he was crying. And I said, "What's wrong?" You know, and he said, "You know, I've treated my brother so badly all my life." And this is quite common. These kinds of insights, you know. And he said, "When I get out of this sesshin, I'm going to call him up and apologize, and tell him how much I love him." And he said, "You know, why have I not done this all my life?" Right? You know, so this experience of mu, of emptiness, is so important. It's our chance to change. It's our chance to see ourselves from another perspective, right? And this is what Bodhidharma was trying to tell the emperor, but the emperor wasn't ready to hear it, right? Maybe America isn't ready to hear this, right? And nothingness sounds so emptiness, it sounds so unappealing, right? But there's some, this spacious, another way to put it is like spaciousness. And we feel so trapped sometimes, we're so trapped in our habits that it seems almost hopeless. How could we ever get out of these habits? Would you sit down on the cushion and you watch your breath and you enter that emptiness, and at first it seems trivial, it's just a little darkness, a little emptiness. But you know, eventually you can fall into this great ocean of emptiness, and you can swim like a whale in the great ocean of emptiness, which is your true home, your true home. You know, someday people will not even understand what Wall Street is. You know, if you're a Star Trek fan, you might know. You know, on the Enterprise, you probably noticed there's no money. You know, Captain Kirk actually talked about this, or maybe it was Picard in one of the shows. He said, "Money? Oh, we stopped using money centuries ago, right?" Really? Somebody say, "Money? What was that?" You know, these pieces of paper, you know, they actually killed each other. They actually destroyed their planet for this, you know. Someday, you know, we may or may not be on the Enterprise, but if humans are around, they'll look back at all this and say, they were living a dream. They were living a dream. And it is a dream. It's a collective dream. You know? You have to live a little bit in the dream. You have to be able to function. You have to get a paycheck every 2 weeks. You have to know you have to put it in the bank, or you have direct deposit. You look at your balance. You can't write checks whenever you like and say it's all a dream, right? That'll get you in trouble. But on the other hand, we also, and some part of us already knows this is all a dream, right? So how do we awaken from the dream? And my feeling is it's zazen and it's mushin, it's empty mind. And you know, our culture has trained us to think and act and feel in certain ways that are not enlightened. But you know, the teaching of the Buddha is that it is possible, nevertheless, to become a deeply enlightened person. But it has to start with your deconditioning yourself and reconditioning yourself. And deconditioning and reconditioning are the work of meditation, are the work of zazen, and the work of wuxin, of mushin. Yeah? If people lose touch with emptiness, I don't know. I don't know. Then I think we're trapped. Right? Then I think they're really, you know, then it's anybody's guess, right? It's, you know. But fortunately, we have this amazing capacity to free ourselves from our own illusions. You know, we're so, the Buddha was right. You know, how lucky we are, right? You know, it's hard work. It's hard work to sit on the cushion. It's hard work to cultivate, you know, it hurt, your legs hurt, you get tired. It's hard to focus. Some days you're just not in the groove. You come to sit and you're antsy, you know, you're nervous. You know, but you know, if you practice, you know, this becomes incredibly liberating. You know, just I've been doing this for almost 40 years, you know. And I actually love it, you know, love it. I was reading something the other day on Facebook, and some Zen monk had written, "Don't fall in love with Zen." And I was very tempted to write, "No, go ahead, fall in love with Zen." He meant people get into Zen, you know, they buy, cushions and mats, they buy, read a lot of books, they get a little thing for their table at work that has a little Zen garden where you can rake the sand. And then they realize this is hard work, right? But you know, actually, if you're in love with somebody, that's hard work too, if it's going to last, right? You know, a romantic relationship is hard work if it turns into love, you know? So that's hard work too. So please fall in love with Zen. It's going to be hard work, but that's everything that's worth doing is challenging. But I promise you, you won't have pain in your legs forever. And, you know, eventually you'll sit down and, you know, I mean, I'm not boasting. I'm just talking about the practice. And I got off my cushion today for our meditation, our walk, and I felt like every atom of my being was clean and it was a bit clean and shiny, you know, like life, energy. And it's not a quality of me. It's a quality of the practice, you know. It's infinitely liberating. You know, when I do this, I feel so young. I feel ageless and full of joy. Right? So there's nothing wrong with that. Please fall in love with that. Smoke over the hill indicates fire. Horns over the fence indicate an ox. Given one corner, you grasp the other three. One glance and you discern the smallest difference. See, those are your mental habits. When you look at something, you already know what you're going to see, right? You see smoke over the hill, you think fire. You see horns over the fence, you think ox. See, that is those are your habitual mental habits. How can you get free from that? See, so no matter what you do, you're always going through the same mental loops, the same cognitive routines. How do you get out of that? See, mushi. Such quickness, however, is only too common. That's not enlightened mind. No. That's common among rogue monks. When you have stopped, but when you have stopped the deluded activity of consciousness, of concept formation, then whatever situation you may find yourself in, you will enjoy perfect freedom in adversity and prosperity, in taking and giving. Now tell me, how in fact will this sort of person behave? When you are that person, what will you do? Main subject, Emperor Wu of Liang asked Bodhidharma, what is the first principle of the holy teachings? Now, many of us would think, oh my God, I'm meeting the emperor. You know, I've got to do this right. I can't screw up. This is my big chance, right? I'm so nervous. Bodhidharma doesn't care, right? Because he dwells in Mushin. The emperor says, what is the first principle of the holy teachings? Bodhidharma just says, he says it like it is. He said it's emptiness. Basically, holiness is baloney. And the emperor, this is the emperor, right? He stands, who are you? Who the hell are you? And Bodhidharma says, not knowing. That is the door to enlightenment. The emperor did not grasp his meaning. Thereupon, Bodhidharma left. Give me another chance, you know. Out. Goodbye. Okay, I tried. Goodbye. Bodhidharma crossed the river and went to the land of Wei. And it doesn't tell us this, but he sat in a cave for 9 years, facing the wall and practicing Zazen, and perfecting his Mushin. And out of the blue, two men and a woman showed up. And those people became his students, and they started Zen in China. The emperor later spoke of this to Shiko, who said, "Do you in fact know who that person is?" The emperor said, he said his name was not knowing. Shiko said, "That is that is Avalokiteshvara. That is the Bodhisattva of compassion, the bearer of the Buddha's heart seal." The emperor was full of regret and wanted to send for Bodhidharma, but Shiko said, "He's gone. But, you know, nevertheless, we can cultivate Mushin." Secho's verse, the holy teaching, emptiness, mu. What is the secret here? Again, who stands before me? Mu.